On September 6th, it's reported in the New Musical Express that Epstein had signed another Liverpool artist, Cilla Black, who will debut with the Lennon and McCartney song Love of the Loved. The same day, Parlophone releases an EP by the Beatles with the tracks Please Please Me, From Me to You, Thank You Girl, and Love Me Do. It's called The Beatles Hits. On the back sleeve, there are some fascinating notes by the Beatles' publicist at the time, Tony Barrow. The four numbers on this EP have been selected from the Lennon and McCartney songbook. If that description sounds a trifle pompous, perhaps I may suggest you preserve this sleeve for 10 years, exhume it from your collection somewhere around the middle of 1973, and write me a very nasty letter if the pop people of the 70s aren't talking with respect about at least two of these titles as early examples of modern beat standards taken from the Lennon and McCartney songbook. How about 50 years, Mr. Barrow? On September 7th, She Loves You reaches the number one position in all charts in Britain and stays there for a total of 7 weeks. On October 13th, the Beatles top the bill on Sunday Night at the London Palladium, a very popular British TV program. An estimated audience of 15 million viewers watched to see what they were about. Fans start riots outside the theater, and the national papers begin to discover Beatlemania. As written in Hunter Davies' biography, Beatlemania descended on the British Isles on October 1963, just as the Christine Keeler Profumo scandal fizzled out. It didn't lift for 3 years, by which time it had spread and had covered the whole world. There was perpetual screaming and yeah-yaying for the whole time, one long, continuous succession of hysterical teenagers of every class and color shouting uncontrollably, not one of who could hear what was going on from the noise of each other. Up in Liverpool, the Beatles' British fan club president, Freda Kelly, becomes inundated with fan mail.
It just came in sackfuls, 2,000 to 3,000 a day. And I used to just close my eyes and go, oh, you know, yeah. Just put it one side and mark the sacks, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But gradually we got through.
The newspaper, The Daily Mirror, says, the Merseysound is the voice of 80,000 crumbling houses and 30,000 people on the dole. The coming of Beatlemania happened suddenly and dramatically, and nobody was really prepared for it. Brian Epstein, in his book A Cellar Full of Noise, said, ever since their beginnings in the cavern, I've known that the Beatles would become major stars. But no one was prepared for the extraordinary events of late autumn 1963, when Britain's youth became enslaved by the music and the personality of the Beatles. Brian's brother Clive was amazed at their incredible popularity.
I always thought the Beatles were intriguing, but obviously it was difficult for me to accept what Brian said, that these guys were definitely going to be bigger than Elvis Presley, of course, in those days, was the giant of them all. And, it will be... I must be honest about this. I really took his remarks with a pinch of salt. I mean, although I was involved with them on a business basis, I couldn't accept what Brian said, that they would be bigger than Elvis.
From this time on, everything changed, said Tony Barrow. My job was never the same again. From spending 6 months ringing up newspapers and getting no, I now had every national reporter and feature writer chasing me. George Harrison gives his impression of British Beatlemania.
Well, we feel flattered.
I'm flattened.
But, if the screaming fans weren't there, then we wouldn't be here, would we?
On October 24th, the Beatles fly to Sweden for 5 concerts and a TV appearance. Thousands of howling, screaming fans converge on London Airport on their departure and again on their arrival.
Twin jet airliner which has flown them from Stockholm. There's a crowd of photographers at the back of the plane. All the passengers came out first. This caused mounting excitement. The flashbulbs are going, 40 or 50 photographers, a lot of airline officials, and now there's quite a crush at the bottom of the steps at the rear of the plane. Scores of people down there with the flashbulbs going as the Beatles try to force their way through. Massive security precautions here to bring them to the main building. The fans are virtually going wild here on the balcony. They're shouting and yelling, and they're having a wonderful time despite the pouring rain. Now the Beatles are making their way towards the main terminal. They're waving and smiling at the crowds. They're wearing shorty black overcoats. The Beatle haircuts stand out for all to see amidst the milling throng down there.
On November 1st, the Beatles release another EP on Parlophone called The Beatles Number One. Four more tracks from the Please Please Me LP. On November 4th, 1963, the Beatles make a triumphant appearance on the Royal Variety Show at the Prince of Wales Theatre. The charity event was attended by all of the show business establishment, minor society, and musical trade people, all hoping to get a glimpse of the Queen Mother, Princess Margaret, and Lord Snowdon. It was an honor for the Beatles to be on the show, but then who could deny the biggest thing to hit Britain since the V2? They did their usual show with their pertinent jokes, and then John makes an introduction to a song that was to be echoed around the world.
For our last number, I'd like to ask your help. Would the people in the cheaper seats clap your hands? And the rest of you, if you just rattle your jewelry. Thank you. We'd like to sing a song called Twist and Shout. One, two, three.
The show was broadcast the following week to an estimated audience of around 26 million viewers. Paul and John give their impressions of this period.
But I think the whole bit really started when we did a Palladium show, and then later we were asked to do the Royal Variety Command performance, you know. And we met the Queen Mother, and she started clapping.
And Princess Margaret, too.
Yeah, and Princess Margaret.
Clive Epstein again.
I think the time when it really hit me was when the Daily Mail developed the four... I don't know whether you remember the type of logo they adopted. It was simply just the four boys' fringes and so forth, and it was, you know, slapped all over the front page. And, of course, then when they had their command performance in 1963, it was at that particular stage that I really... I realised that this was probably the biggest event in entertainment since goodness knows when. I mean, I'm quite sure there hadn't been anything similar for, well, maybe since Rudolph Valentino.
In the fall of 1963, it had become fashionable to be a Beatle fan in Britain. Grandmothers and tiny children joined the middle and teenage ranks, and practically everyone was clamoring to associate themselves with them. But apart from Stockholm, there was little interest overseas. At this point, manufacturers all over Britain were competing to get a concession to use the word Beatle on their products. Fans could buy copies of the collarless jackets, which were especially designed by Pierre Cardin. They could buy Beatle boots and even Beatle wigs. Most boys were growing their hair in the Beatle length and style, and some were told to leave school or work to get it trimmed. On November 16th, all three American networks send crews to the Bournemouth concert, and a few days later, Americans get their first look at the Beatles. The next day, a photo reporting team from Life magazine meets them at the Coventry Theatre. Paul McCartney says, "We're tickled pink over the American interest in us." 5 days later, the Beatles release their second album on Parlophone Records, with advance orders of 250,000 plus. The LP was called With the Beatles. The cover showed their four faces cleverly lit from one side, and was a certain steal from the work in Hamburg of Astrid's. Its stark artsy quality in black and white set the image of the Beatles for many years to come. The production quality was up because EMI had more money to spend on the sessions, and the music on it was yet another step in their growing talent as fine composers and performers. The opening track, with lead vocal by John, shows the vitality of the Beatles as a group. It's a powerful treatment of a Lennon and McCartney original and gave an indication of what the album was all about.
It won't be long yet.
The next piece, written mostly by John, was influenced by R&B performer Arthur Alexander, whose song Anna appeared on the first album.
Whenever I want you around, yeah, all I gotta do is call you on the phone and you come running home. Yeah, that's all I gotta do. And when I wanna kiss you, yeah, all I gotta do is whisper in your ear the words you long to hear, and I'll be kissing you. And the same goes for me.
This song started out as a piece of poetry by Paul. Later, he added the music. It showed the quality which they were achieving as songwriters. This song became so popular that it soon surfaced again as the title track to an EP, along with three others. Later, in America, it was put out as a single and immediately became number one. The guitar triplets by John are great, and George's solo work, inspired by Chet Atkins, is the best playing by him yet on record. It was one of their great early songs. Paul sings it.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day and I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend that I'm missing the lips and hope that my dreams will come true. And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you. All my loving, darling, I'll be true. Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving I will send to you.
George Harrison makes his debut as a writer on this next song. Here he explains.
The first song I ever wrote was in Bournemouth about, must have been about 1963. It was after our first success and we were doing weekly shows in holiday resorts. So we were in Bournemouth, and I was feeling sick. In fact, I was in bed sick, and the doctor was giving me some tonic. And I just thought, oh, I'll see if I can write a song. So I wrote one, and it was an awful song, and it was called Don't Bother Me, which I suppose is how I felt at the time.
The inspiration might have come from Bill Harry.
I kept on to George, and every time I see George coming out of a club or something, I'd rap it to him and said, look, when are you going to write some songs? And he didn't want to be bothered, so I kept on and on at him. And he got almost frightened every time he saw me. Oh, dear, he's going to pester me again, you see. And I kept on, look, George, you've got to write songs. Why don't you write some songs, you know? How come it's all Lennon McCartney? You write some songs. So I pestered the life out of him. And when I went to see him, the ABC Blackpool, he said, Bill, he said, thank God you pestered me. He said, one night, he said, I couldn't bear the idea of seeing you again. So I sat down and thought, God, I might see him tomorrow night. So he says, he wrote a song called Don't Bother Me, you know? And he said, I wrote that because, you know, I thought you'd be on at me again. And he says, thanks very much, because he said, I made thousands of pounds out of it. I think at the time the ABC Blackpool, they told me he'd made £8,000 already out of it.
Till she's here, please don't come near, just stay away. I'll let you know when she's come home until that day. Don't come around, leave me alone, don't bother me.
A rather raunchy, fast-paced piece follows with Paul and John on vocals. Paul's on piano and John's on harmonica.
Take a chance.
Paul McCartney becomes a balladeer again with his interpretation of the hit from The Music Man. John and George play some fine acoustic lines behind him, and Ringo plays bongos. Supposedly, this song was a favorite at the Cavern.
There were bells on a hill, but I never heard them ringing. No, I never heard them at all, till there was you. There were birds in the sky, but I never saw them winging. No, I never saw them at all, till there was you. Then there was music and wonderful roses, they tell me, in sweet, fragrant meadows of dawn and dew. There was love all around, but I never heard it singing. No, I never heard it at all, till there was you.
Saving the best for last, the final track on side one is great. It's one of three Motown hits convincingly covered on the album, and it too was a big Cavern favorite. A fine three-voice treatment with John's strong lead vocal double-tracked and George and Paul singing along as well. The Marvelettes, who had covered the song themselves, loved the Beatles' version.
Girlfriend so far away.
Side two opens with a rock and roll classic, Chuck Berry's Roll Over Beethoven. It had always been a big favorite in their live performances. George Harrison sings and plays lead guitar. Incidentally, the song was released in North America first as a single by Capitol of Canada. The U.S. demand for it was so phenomenal that truckloads of 45s had to be shipped to the States, where it soon became a big hit. Wrote this song, on which he sings lead vocal accompanied by John and George.
No, no.
John and George sing lead on a very respectful version of Smokey Robinson's You Really Got a Hold on Me.
We were really into Tamla Motown just around the time it was first breaking into all those sort of things. I always liked the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles from that period. And I found myself playing a lot of his records.
After the tremendous response to Ringo singing Boys in concert, John and Paul wrote this next piece especially for him. John is playing Hammond organ.
I wanna be your man.
That song was covered by the Rolling Stones, and it became their first top 10 hit in Britain. Come On, their first record, established them, but this one really got the Stones going. In order to establish themselves, they asked their friends the Beatles if they had any R&B songs that they could record, and John and Paul gave them this one. It's strange to think that the Stones started their careers off doing the Beatles. The Beatles showed their respect for the American girl group The Donnays by doing their song Devil in Her Heart. Paul altered the lyrics a bit, sang harmony to George's lead, and had Ringo play the maracas.
She's got the devil.
The last original composition on the album was written mostly by John. He does a double-tracked lead vocal, and again we have George Martin on piano. This was the song William Mann wrote about in the London Times. John says he went on about the flat submedian key switches and the Aeolian cadence at the end being like Mahler's Song of the Earth. Really, it was just chords like any other chords.
You know you made me cry. I see no use in wondering why.
When they did the song Money in concert with John's screaming vocal, they got the same overwhelming response as from Twist and Shout. This really big screamer, as Paul described it, was a much-covered classic originally done by Barrett Strong. Along with George Martin on piano and John's powerful vocal, it finished off the album with excitement and promise of great things to come. About this time, their producer, George Martin, described his responsibilities in the recording.
My main role was that of tidying up the basic unit of three guitars and drums and the occasional keyboard. And in fact, in those days, if there was a keyboard used, it was generally me who played it, whereas later on, John and Paul did much more. So that in the early days, and as I've described in Can't Buy Me Love, I would just sort of do a little bit of manipulation to get a slightly more concise arrangement.
Capitol of Canada released their version of With the Beatles 3 days later under the name Beatlemania with the Beatles. The Beatles were already enjoying good sales and airplay in Canada, especially after the success of She Loves You. But it was a different story in America. Two smaller companies, VJ and Swan, were releasing the material without generating much interest, although that was soon to change. Producer George Martin could not understand why Capitol Records, EMI's American counterpart, would not release the Beatles' records.
I got increasingly frustrated because our American counterparts in Capitol had always been slightly superior, saying, well, of course, you don't really know in England about rock and roll. I mean, we are the fountainhead of rock and roll, and we should know about it. And every time a record was rejected by them, I said, I guess they must be right, you know. And then with the second one, well, are they right? And by the third time, I know damn well they're not right. You know, I got increasingly hard about it. In some of the stations in America, the Beatle records issued on the Swan and VJ labels and so on were getting more and more prominent. And I guess the Capitol people were getting cold feet by this time. They were aware they'd turned it down three times. And I guess they said, well, you know, maybe we want to try this. And then, of course, by the time the I Want You Want to Hold Your Hand came along, they realized they had to get behind it. And that was it was like a dam bursting. The pressure was too great. And that really what contributed to the enormous success of the Beatles in America, with men wearing silly Beatle wigs on Fifth Avenue and all that kind of thing. Yeah.
In November, Brian flies to New York to arrange the release of their new single on Capitol Records. While in New York, he meets with Ed Sullivan to have the Beatles make two appearances on his show. Ed Sullivan was already aware of the Beatles' success.
For years, we've visited London. So on one of our arrivals in late 1963 at London Airport, when Mrs. Sullivan and I saw hundreds and hundreds of youngsters, I asked what celebrity was arriving. And they told us the teenagers were awaiting the Beatles. Always on the lookout for talent, I decided the Beatles would be a good TV attraction for our show. So I contacted Brian Epstein, their manager, and we agreed on $10,000 for three shows, plus five round-trip plane tickets, plus their expenses for room and board in New York City.
One of the first to notice the Beatles in America was a Columbia University night student named Sid Bernstein. He had been reading of the riots the Beatles inspired as reported in the British pop papers. He thought there must be something in it and felt they would go over in America as well. So he contacted Brian Epstein in London and arranged for the first Beatle appearance in America.
I started to read some things about the Beatles and Beatlemania long before I'd even heard a record of theirs or even read much in our trade press. And I decided that if Beatlemania had touched England, it was inevitable that it would touch our shores. And so I did 3 weeks of exploratory work and found this young man that I'd been reading about, who was their manager, found Brian Epstein's home number. And I got him at home. And this was the summer of 63.
The date was set for February 12th, and the place, Carnegie Hall. Meanwhile, back in Britain, on November 29th, 1963, Parlophone released their next Beatles single, just 7 days after the last album. It was called I Wanna Hold Your Hand, and was written in the basement of Jane Asher's parents' house on Wimpole Street. It was another attempt at doing a mock American gospel song in the hope that it would break into the American charts. It finally did, reaching number one on February 1st, 1964. In Britain, the song had advance orders of 1 million copies.
Say
Their success seemed to spur them on as songwriters. George Martin explains.
John and Paul, having found out that it was comparatively easy to make a hit with Please Please Me and then From Me to You, they said, great, we know how to do it. And it became a production line. And so their ingenuity was actually spurred on by their success at that stage. And they were thinking of fresh ideas and new things. And each song that came out seemed to be a good one.
The B-side, written by John, is a magnificent piece of three-part harmony, with Paul singing the top line, John the lower, and George in the middle. On December 6th, as a special Christmas treat to all of their fan club members, the Beatles send their first Christmas message. Tony Barrow, press and PR man for the Beatles, explains its origin.
Now, I thought of something that I don't think anybody had used before, the idea of doing a little record, not with a song on it or anything like that, but doing something different.
It was actually recorded on October 20th, but regardless of the season, this seemingly spontaneous bit of Beatle goodwill and humor thrilled the fan club members.
could King Wenceslas last look out on the feast of Stephen, as the slow ray round about, deep and crispy, brightly showed the boot last night on the musty cruel. Henry Hall and David Lloyd, Betty Grable too.
Hello, this is John speaking with his voice. We're all very happy to be able to talk to you like this on this little bit of plastic. This record reaches you at the end of a really gear year for us, and it's all due to you. When we made our first record on Parlophone toward the end of 1962, we hoped everybody would like what we'd already been our type of music for several years already. But we had no idea of all the gear things in store for us. It all happened, really, when Please Please Me became a number one hit, and after that, well, Court of Blimey's He the Know. Our biggest thrill of the year, well, I suppose it must have been topping the bill at the London Palladium, and then, only a couple of days later, being invited to take part in the Royal Variety Show. This time last year, we were all dead chuffed because Love Me Do got into the top 20, and we can't believe, really, that so many things have happened in between already. Just before I pass you over to Paul, I'd like to say thank you to all the Beatle people who have written to me during the year, and everyone who sent me gifts and cards for my birthday, which I'm trying to forget, in October. I'd love to reply personally to everyone, but I just haven't enough pens. In the meantime, Gary Crimble to you, Gary Mimble to you, Geddy Babel, dear Christmas, happy birthday, me too.
This is Paul here. Everything that John said goes for me too, especially the bit about birthday cards and apostles. Because all our homes and offices got stacks of mail last year.
Ow!
Well, it was my birthday. Anyway, we're all dead pleased by the way you've treated us in 1963. And we'll try to do everything we can to please you with the type of songs we write and record next year. Oh, yeah. Somebody asked us if we still like Jelly Babies. Well, we used to like them. In fact, we loved them. And we said so in one of the papers, you see. Ever since then, we've been getting them in boxes, packets and crates. Anyway, we've gone right off Jelly Babies, you see. But we still like Peppermint Creams and Chocolate Drops and Donny Mitchell's and all those sort of things, don't
we? Yes, yes, oh yes.
Well, lots of people asked us what we enjoy best, you see. Concert and television or recording. We like doing stage shows because, you know, it's great to hear an audience enjoying themselves. But the thing we like best, I think so anyway, is going into the recording studio.
Yeah, lovely. We enjoy that.
Love
very
that,
kindly.
To make new records, which is what we've been doing all day before we started on this special message. Well, what we like to hear most is one of our songs, you know, taking shape in a recording studio, one of the ones what John and I have written. And then listening to the tapes afterwards to hear how it all worked out, you see. Well, I'm running over my time and people are telling me to stop.
Stop shouting those animals.
I'll finish now with it. Wishing everyone happy Crimble and a Merry New Year, and especially all the ones who paid the subscription.
Ja, das wird und danke schön, und den Christmon eben, da den Christmon either schon. Ja, das wird wunderschön, boy.
Danke schön. Ja, Ringo.
Hello, Ringo here. As you know, I was the last member to join the Beatles. I started to play drums in the group 1962. I've been a couple of other groups.
Oh, just wish the people merry, happy. Go on for Christmas.
Merry Happy New Year, and folks, Happy Christmas, and may everything you wish be granted.
Singers Wenceslas,
King Wenceslas. King Wenceslas last looked down on the feast of Stephen, when the snow was on the ground, deep and crisp and even.
Thank you, Ringo. We'll phone you. I'm George Harrison. Nobody else has said anything yet about our fan club secretaries, Anne Collingham and Betty, you know, Rose. Not to mention Frida Kelly in Liverpool.
Get out, Frida!
So on behalf of us all, I'd just like to say a great big thank you to Anne, Bettina and Frida for all the hard work they've done. And we just hope you can go on pleasing you for a long time. Because it's your reaction to our records that really matters. And I'd just like to say, brightly was the shone that night, though the winter cruel, when a pork pie came inside, gathering winter cruel.
New dollar in a grain day, had a very shiny nose, when everybody told him,
Nicky the red-nosed negro, had a very shiny nose.
Merry Christmas, everybody!
On December 7th, all four Beatles appear on the BBC TV program Jukebox Jury for an audience of millions. In its end-of-the-year charts, the New Musical Express certified the Beatles as the world's number one group. The Beatles received 14,696 votes. The closest American group was the Everly Brothers, with just over 3,000. The highest-selling records of the year were She Loves You, with 1.3 million sales, and I Want to Hold Your Hand, with 1.25 million. The Times music critic called John and Paul the outstanding English composers of 1963, and the Sunday Times music critic called them the greatest composers since Beethoven. The Mersey Beat had conquered Britain.
One of the things, we were trying to find the next beat, because everyone was talking about all the musicals, it was in New Musical Express then, and they were talking about rock calypso, you know, Latin rock is going to be the next, and we used to sit around there thinking, now, what's going to be the next beat, and we'd write. And when the minute we stopped trying to find that next beat, the newspaper said, it's Mersey Beat. And we found that we'd discovered the next beat without even trying to discover it.
1963 was a year of hard work by all the people involved, and they could be very proud of their success. But it was only the beginning. 1964 would be even more incredible. The year started for the Beatles on January 3rd with I Want to Hold Your Hand reaching number one in Australia. On the 20th, Capitol US released Meet the Beatles, which was a collection of songs culled from their first and second British albums. At the beginning of January, Dave Clark Five's Glad All Over replaces I Want to Hold Your Hand, and the British press have a field day headlining, The Tottenham Sound Has Crushed the Beatles. On January 15th, the Beatles make their French debut at the Paris Olympia, beginning a three-week season at the theater. Trini Lopez and Sylvia Vartan share the stage with them. 40 curious pressmen meet them at the Le Bourget airport, but no fans. After some clapping by the reporters, John says, "Merci beaucoup." By the time they were ready to leave Paris, there are wailing and chanting mobs surging around the theater. The Beatles were in their suite at the George Sank Hotel in Paris when Brian found out that I Want to Hold Your Hand, coupled with I Saw Her Standing There, was at the top of the charts in America.
We were playing in Paris at the time, and Telegram came, and we all jumped on each other's backs and ran around everywhere. And Big Mal, the roadie, used to give everyone piggybacks everywhere. We were just so excited.
George Martin was with them, and they all had a big celebration dinner. He was in Paris to make a record with them. The EMI people in Germany had insisted that the Beatles would get bigger sales if their songs were sung in German. The Beatles didn't want to do it. They believed the original English version was all the people wanted to hear, as they had played them to German audiences for years.
I said, look, chaps, if we do want to have German sales, let's do it. Go along with them. Let's see what they can do. So they sent over their A&R guy, Otto Demmler, I think his name was, who was an actor, a kind of liaison, and he prepared the translation of the lyrics, which weren't terribly subtle. I mean, She Loves You became Sie liebt dich, for example. Mm-hmm. And it was I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You. And so they, in fact, were on the appointed day, they didn't turn up. And I was waiting at the studios with Otto Demmler, waiting them to turn up. And the time went by, and I rang their hotel. And Neil Aspinall said, well, I'm sorry, but they're not coming. They asked me to tell you they're not coming. I said, you mean tell me they're telling you to tell me? They're not telling me themselves. That's right. I said, you what? I'm coming right back. I'm coming right back, and I'm going to say hello to everybody. So I rushed into the Georges Sank, which is where they were staying. And they were all having tea in the centre of the room, rather like the Mad Hatter's tea party, because Alice in Wonderland, in other words, Jane Asher with her long golden hair, was pouring tea in the middle. And as soon as I entered the room, they all exploded in all directions. They ran behind couches, behind, one put a lampshade on his head to hide, you know, they just did goon things of hiding. And a kind of chorus came from behind the set sofa, sorry George, sorry George, sorry George, sorry George. And of course, you couldn't be angry with him for too long. And I said, well, you're going to apologize to Otto Demmler, because I had him with me. And they said, sorry Otto, sorry Otto. And they came back and they did the recording. And of course, they were right.
Last he leaves the mist, yes, and how big seek
The lyrics, when translated, sound as if George had got Peter Sellers to do it for them. On January 24th, 64, it's reported in Cashbox that the Beatles' success is the main talking point of the American recording industry, and that it could change the whole thinking of American companies towards all British records from now on. Back in Paris, American magazine and newspaper reporters converge on the Beatles, asking all the same questions. It must have been extremely exciting for them now, knowing that they had the top record in the U.S., land of their musical idols. In order to further heighten the interest in the Beatles that the media was finally beginning to show them, Brian Epstein convinced Capitol in the U.S. to do a crash publicity program costing $50,000. They were still unsure of what their reception in America would be like, because British artists had never done well in the U.S. Even Cliff Richard had failed to raise much interest. So 5 million posters declaring the Beatles are coming appeared throughout the states. Disc jockeys received a set of all the Beatle records released so far, and an open-ended interview the Beatles taped especially for the American invasion. Here's what it sounded like.
And right now, here we have the Beatles! Come on in, fellas. Come on, sit around the mic here. How you doing, anyway? Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
By the way, fellas, who's your barber? You do have one, though, don't you?
No, it's a dirty rumor we don't. We cut it ourselves.
Well, which one of you guys dreamed up this haircut idea anyway?
I think it was my dad, really. He said, you know, Paul, this is a bit square, this the haircut I had, you know, short back and side. He said, why don't you go Beatle cut, son? Thanks.
Okay, fellas, what are you doing here and what are your plans for the States?
Well, we're over here to do 3 Ed Sullivan TV shows. And meet the press. And a bit of a rest on Miami Beach.
Hey, I hear you guys are going to make a beach blanket bingo type movie soon or something like that.
Yeah, well, when we get back to England from this current visit of America,
America.
Well, we're making a film which we don't know the title of, but it's going to be a film just about us.
We don't know the script, and we don't know what songs it'll be in it.
It should be released in the States about the end of this year sometime, we hope.
With no title and no song and no script. Top that.
I give it.
Oh, sounds like a winner already. Hey, thanks, Beatles, and we'll see you later.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just to show that they were fully behind the Beatles, Capitol's executives were photographed duly attired in their new Beatle wigs. As Capitol's Voyle Gilmore remarked on all the hype, sure there was a lot, but all the hype in the world isn't going to sell a bad product. It's ironic to think that in the past, Capitol had continually turned down the Beatles' music and let VJ and Swan put their records out. Interest was growing, and on January 31st, it was reported that She Loves You had sold 1 million copies in the U.S., and I Want to Hold Your Hand, 2 million. The American LP Meet the Beatles had already sold 750,000 copies. In the beginning of February, an American group called the Swans released The Boy with the Beatle Hair. Sonny Curtis recorded a Beatle I Want to Be. A group called the Liverpools had brought out an LP called Beatlemania in the U.S., and the Buddies have released an instrumental called simply The Beatles.